I'll just say a few words about what the project is, and then just ask you guys for any points that you would want to bring to that discussion, and then we can just go for it. We can have questions, conversations, etc., etc. So very briefly, this is really part of the what we're calling the Human Transcendence Project, which was inspired by a group in which we were reading the work of Peter Sloterdijk, who's a modern philosopher who's reworking ideas from Nietzsche. And his idea is this: in a modern world, which is a kind of secular materialist world, we're material beings, we're animals, we don't have some higher transcendence that we refer ourselves to in our lives, it's just us. But in such a world, to what extent do we simply play through the same old stories of survival day after day? Are all our concerns and all our systems and all of human life set in a kind of a fixed rotation of basic concerns for food and shelter and reproduction? What is it, by contrast, says Sloterdijk, what is it that pushes us forward from time to time to seek things which are very impractical, to seek things which are excessive to the basic survival needs of life, to pursue these very odd things, which may be art, which may be ideals-driven things, which may appear, at least, to not fit immediately into those kinds of systems which appear to be merely about survival. And Sloterdijk talks about this in terms of Nietzsche's ideas, that even in a secular world without God, you still get a kind of transcendence, because humans have something in them that pushes upward already. What's interesting about that, says Sloterdijk, is in the modern world, we see this, but we don't know where it comes from. And actually, often we're speaking to scientists, to physicists, to biologists, to ask what the human is, but we don't know how to address those strange elements of transcendence that we find within the human world, to explain them. What forces are there in us that push in these strange directions towards what Bataille kind of calls excess? You know, there's that which we use for practical purposes, and then a strange excess which generates other things. So we've had in previous sessions people working on science and religion, on affect theory, on Indian philosophy, on literary context of thinking about human nature and its drive, Emerson and other philosophers. And we really want this to be interdisciplinary, so we will also be speaking to people working on the modern novel, what Proust and Dostoevsky and Robert Musil thought about that strange human drive. But actually, this isn't going to work unless we have words from people who understand the human system and all it involves better than your average me, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're turning over here to the doctors Lotto, Lenka Izquierdo, and David Barrett, who've just introduced themselves. And really what I want to do is open this up to you to speak to this issue. We all work on areas that are related to culture, to human development, to these extraordinary extra faculties that humans have. Anything you'd like to offer to that? So does anyone want to start us off with any thoughts?
Let me just add that this is our guest, Maz Kuan.
Hello.
And Maz is running wisher.com. She introduced herself.
Perfect.
Where some 20,000 people wished, 100 that had 150 wishes, 150,000 wishes. Mm-hmm. And so she actually knows about what how people try to transcend their own lives. So we thought, what a weird coincidence. So
that's very good. Yeah, and thank you so much for coming. That's really wonderful. That's great. It'd be interesting, indeed, contemporary ways in which people pursue these strange extra things with the extra life space that we've achieved in the modern world. That's very important. Without that, we can't understand it.
I have a one-line summary. Mm-hmm. I hear a contraposition in what you're suggesting. That is, the main question here, do we replay stories of survival and mere human materialism, and is it all about food, reproduction, and the endless cycle of avoiding predators and keeping ourselves safe? And then where do we put the other, the excessive, the ethereal, the beautiful, the experiential? In a nutshell, I do not think these are separate. I think they are one. And I think it's not humans also further. So that's the main point, really. And the second main point is that I do not think humans are the ones who brought this into being one. and then let's develop that. But it just writing down the question, the words impractical, excessive, odd, idea driven, excess, all of that. And again, kind of the German romantics, the German idealists saw this, because Nietzsche and Schiller mainly, I could not believe in a God that could not dance, and the play drive, of course, it's the same, is one and the same thing. So we as the human animal, it's part of our survival drive to engage in these ridiculous, excessive, aesthetic, costly. We die. Whether we just, it's play failed and we go to A&E, or if we're in a pursuit of an aesthetic ideal. So that's basically the one line to start. I do not see these are separate. I think they're part of the same thing.
That's really helpful. And just to clarify, that it's wrong to create this dichotomy, that actually the things we see as more are part of the survival mechanisms.
Yeah.
And I like your idea that this is costly. It's not that we do those just happen to do.
It's costly, but not to do it is fatal.
Mm-hmm.
So
costly.
It's so to play is costly, but not to do it is fatal. So because of course we're getting at this, it's the idea of cost, and cost comes in many shapes and forms. It's financial cost, it's time cost, it's social risk. Risk and cost are different things. You're risking your reputation, you're risking many things. It's also you're risking life and limb. You know, you fall from stuff when you're trying stupid things. You know, why do we climb mountains? You know, it's like the aesthetic ideal of to transcend the boundaries of what we think is the lowlands. So cost and risk comes in many shapes, but I think we're all here interested in transcendence because we have a notion that not to approach transcendence is fatal. It's fatal for the spirit, right? We want to live. Almost, we just don't want to survive, we want to live. And that's what I mean by it's costly, but not to do it is fatal.
Mm-hmm.
It's the mechanism by which keeps our minds and spirits alive. Mm-hmm. You know, a spirit that wants to apprehend the world, that goes, oh yeah, this is fun, I want to see. That's the spirit that will live, that will continue because it wants to.
Mm-hmm.
Not to want to is to die.
That's interesting. So biologically, we shouldn't think of humans as just taking machines that take in material, produce survival, and carry on. There's a kind of a pleasure drive or a joy or some kind of live drive.
Yeah.
Doesn't agree with everything Isabel says, of course, necessarily. So, I don't think it has to be a joy or a pleasure or anything like that. I think it's far more fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a necessity to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's interesting because I'm coincidentally reading this.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I'm reading this, Suicide, because actually I think suicide is an example of transcendence in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because why do people commit suicide? There's lots and lots of reasons. And actually, I don't know any evidence of animals that commit suicide other than us. They will sacrifice themselves. Bumblebees and honeybees are an example. They will kill themselves.
There is some evidence. It's very contentious, but there is some evidence.
And I bet it's higher, but I would suggest that actually it should be a continuum.
Mm.
It shouldn't just be humans, but it might be more evident here. Why? Because when you have everything that you need biologically, in the sense of food or shelter, what is it that you're lacking? And what you're lacking is the thing that the brain evolved to do in the first place, which is to make meaning. So that's why I think transcendence is actually incredibly mundane. It isn't this thing that we are sometimes transcending and sometimes not. I think we always are, because we never see the world as it really is. Impossible.
Can you just, because
so
I know
back.
What you mean, but I think
you
should do. You should stay a little bit more.
But I'm going
by
to get there.
Yeah.
It'll just be
maybe
about 2.5 hours. So, no, the point is that the reason why everything that Isabel is saying about going forward and exploring is because your brain, nothing that your brain receives in terms of information is meaningful. It literally does not come in the instructions. It doesn't tell you what to do. So in order for your brain to survive, it has to construct a meaning. The only way it can do that is by physically engaging with the world. That's the fundamental drive, right? One way is through play and the motivation of playing. There'll be others, like fear is a tremendous driver to explore the world. And as a consequence, you get this information, and then you make a meaning out of it. It's the meaning that you're literally seeing. You don't see what's there. You don't see the information.
The meaning arises in interaction. That's what
in the same way that the meaning of a whirlpool doesn't exist in the analysis of any of the water molecules. So the whirlpool transcends the water molecules. It doesn't make it some higher level thing. It's because the whirlpool exists in the interaction between the stuff. And that's where life lives. Reductionist science tends to remove the very thing that it's trying to study, which is life. And life lives in interaction between stuff. Mm-hmm. Right?
So that's really helpful. And so then it's wrong to think of the human mind as simply a sort of computer that has one specific goal, which is to certain survival things it needs, and that it merely processes that activity. Rather, it needs to make reference to a bigger picture of meaning.
The survival is the construction of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
They're not one. They're not one or the other. They're mm-hmm. the same thing, which is what you were also referring to.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
So hence this book. I think what's happening is that people lack. They have everything they need physically, but what they're lacking is the meaning,
mm-hmm.
because the brain evolved. It needs that, mm-hmm. because to not have that was to die.
And what suicide then is what happens when you can't get the meaning? Or? Mm-hmm.
Very simplistically, there are lots of. I mean, I'm really curious to know what people feel about what transcendence actually is, because we use the word, but I still don't know what you mean by transcendence necessarily.
I looked up in the dictionary.
Uh-huh. It's your turn, so you go ahead. Uh-huh.
I agree with, of course, exactly with everything that Isabel said, and I even more agree with everything you said. But I will argue.
I
that
disagree with you.
I agree. I will argue that transcendence doesn't actually exist.
Now you have to define it.
Very similar reasons that you listed. I think you just have shown us that transcendence doesn't. So, from an evolutionary scientific point of view, so if you're explaining behavior that you see using an evolutionary framework, then every behavior that we see, you would expect, comes from some background, has some kind of foundations. And I observe that this particular primate species, humans, are exceedingly social. So independent of where you live on the planet, you are going to be born to a mother who will have to look after you, somebody will have to look after you, or you will simply not survive. And then you will learn your technologies with which you are manipulating your environment from the older generation or your older siblings. And then you're going to manipulate the environment together with others. You're going to grow stuff together. You're going to hunt stuff together. You're going to find stuff together, gather stuff together. And you're going to cook it together. And in fact, the technology of cooking is an exceedingly social thing. And you will build houses together. You can't really, most places on Earth, you can't build your own space yourself where you're gonna sleep. You will be surrounded by predators. You will have no chance with your feeble little feet and hands and without weapons that you learn from others and you make together with others, and without doing the defense together with others. In fact, you are going to be fighting against other groups, and unless you do that, they will take away and kill everybody and take over your land. And to do this, you will need to have a set of behaviors that will keep the group together. So you will tell stories together. You will engage in collective eating together. You will have some rituals together. You're going to play together. You're going to make music together. You're going to make dance together. So I would argue that all of these behaviors, the foundation of all of these behaviors, are coming from an evolutionary origin. Now, having said that, I'd like to share a little anecdote that just happened to me recently, which will negate everything I just have said. I was at the Burning Man Festival with these two guys, and in the middle of the Burning Man Festival, I don't know whether you know.
Ask if people know what the Burning Man.
Yeah, so the Burning Man Festival is a 7-day festival in the middle of the Nevada desert, and then in the very middle there's a temple. It's a temple. It's 5 stories high, and I had gone out there, in my behavioral science hat on. I cycled in the middle of the desert, and I walked into this beautiful, beautiful space. And there were a few hundred, maybe 500 people around there, everybody crying. And it was very interesting for me. I said, well, how interesting this is that everybody cries here. And of course, I was observing people as they were crying, and I was coming up with different kind of explanations of the crying behavior that I observed and what kind of bonding is taking place. And gone again, because it was really interesting. So I gone out again, and everybody was crying. And it's like, wow, this is really interesting. And then I talked to one of the founders of the festival, and I told her this story. And she said, Tomasz, why didn't you go out yourself rather than as a scientist? So I took off all my clothes. I wore one cape, and I walked out in the middle of the scoring heat in the sandstorm, and walked for 25 minutes in barefooted, whatever. And I arrived there, and I cried like a baby for 15 minutes. And the transcendence of what you would call, I think, transcendence, hit me really hard. But of course, the scientists had to come back and negate this experience.
Can I just tell what the temple does?
Do you tell them what the temple does?
It's just to understand the context, because it's such a wonderful point where he's saying the whole of the festival is about celebration and play and things like, and art and things are going to get burned, and people are trying new things and are making fun stuff. It's dangerous, it's fun. There's this one place, which is the temple, where the mood is very different. It's a temple. It used to be a temple of joy. It's called now the temple of remembrance. So that's where people put mostly, it's to remember the dead. So everyone who's had somebody die goes and writes something. So it's very, that's why people are crying. They're not just crying randomly in a spot. They're crying because you enter and you start seeing, you know, babies that died, my burner friend that was actually killed in the Paris attack last year, and, you know, my grandma, or sometimes in remembrance of our relationship that is now dead. And you get actually quite overwhelmed, and it happens in that space. So anyway, that's why he arrived and he saw people crying.
And so what's happened? Okay, I'll finish. Well, the point I wanted to make is that actually you can figure out that what kind of molecules are being evaporated from people's tears that other people are then smelling that might trigger a collective crying phenomenon. There are auditory signals that, so basically what you see is, I presume, we haven't done the research yet, is that you see a collective act of crying with projected stories, projected narratives that people build together. So my problem with this whole concept of transcendence, I don't have a problem, but it's not separate from normal.
Yeah. That's really helpful. Can I just ask?
So I agree with you, though.
I knew that you were going to.
No, but you can't agree so quickly.
You went a long way to agree.
Can I ask a quick question just to clarify and ask you then about what this transcendence thing could be? If we want to redefine it,
yes,
right? What would be a good way to redefine it in the modern world? And maybe you can come in and tell us if you have thoughts about that as well. But it sounds like what you're saying is people who understand this development from, if you like, the biological through to the cultural in a way that a lot of people don't. A, they shouldn't be separated, and B, that there are particular things that signal the shift to the next level, that could be that living is not merely a biological process, but it's something you do. There has to be qualitative value to the experience of living. Something like that?
Yeah, I am life that wills to live, in the middle of life that wills to live. It's a wonderful line by Alfred Schweitzer that I think it captures. That's kind of essence of it.
And actually
the will to live.
Yeah,
you know?
There's a qualitative thing. So living is not merely a state, it's a qualitative process.
It's not something that, not only something that you do, it's also something that you feel.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling of what happens. And that's where you get into kind of the whole kind of consciousness qualia thing. But we need to get back ultimately to the nature of experience.
That's great. That's nice, partly because this whole thing came out of readings in phenomenology, which is the study of experience.
Yes.
Essential.
Yes.
And for Bo particularly, it came out an idea which is close to my heart in the work of people like Peter Berger, but the idea of that meaning, we have to have a meaningful world, that we're not merely things that process data, get stuff, and go back into a loop, that we're engaging with a much, what the mind is at this higher level is something that is engaged with meaning, and that's part of survival. Mm-hmm. Something like that?
Yeah. And that's the feelings are the meaning. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't make a distinction between them.
Yeah, okay, good.
Perception is the meaning. Okay. It's not, again, that there's not one or the other. Mm-hmm.
And the tendency to divide experience into perception, cognition, and emotion.
I think it's wrong. Mm-hmm. In physical behavior, it's all wrong. Mm-hmm. You can't fundamentally separate them. Psychologists and anatomists tend to like to try to separate because they're doing the same thing as they do with the whirlpool. They separate and do the reductionist approach, and they study the water molecules, and as a consequence, they actually kill the thing that they're trying to study. Mm-hmm. They remove it, literally, because they've lost interactions. Mm-hmm. So it's everything lives in the space between, in a sense. The reason why we see what we do is not because you have a particular brain structure as such. It has everything to do with the process that led to this brain structure. And also, I'd qualify with experience.
I think, meaning that the history of a system matters. So we see through our history. It's not that the present structure does not matter. It's that the present structure exists because it has a given history.
Yes.
Hence, for us, evolutionary biology is that history. It's nothing but deep history. Really.
Agreed, though I do mean it quite literally. And that the structure of my brain doesn't matter because the structure of my brain is very different from your brain and your brain. Mm-hmm. So the absolute structures don't actually matter. And we don't actually know what matters. And something exists in the commonality between all these structures. And we don't know what that is yet. Mm-hmm. What we do is we tend to study a particular brain, but all brains
vary. I completely disagree with what you just said.
Structures matter, but come on.
Go ahead.
Anyway, let them chew. Yeah.
But that's really helpful, and that's something that a friend of mine was saying, that people are only studying the brain in one context, one kind of calculation.
Exactly.
And that's keying into things like the fact-value problem in philosophy, where we only study fact structures, but we don't study value structures.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a very simple way to make this point. You have a three-celled network, only three cells, right? It's an extant network where one exists, you give an input, it generates an output. Okay, that's the one we study. You can randomly generate millions of three-celled networks. They're all biologically plausible. You give them the same input, they generate the same output. If you select all those, you get 500,000 three-celled networks that are biologically plausible that do exactly the same thing. So when I say the structure doesn't matter, of course the structure is relevant for all of them. But the point is, what's interesting is, what's common across all these 500,000? Because not any one of them is meaningful. It is for that system, but the answer doesn't live in understanding that structure. It's in the common principles across all the structures that's significant.
It's partly the emergent structures that actually happening at another level. Yeah, interesting. Tamash, do you want to? So, and I was going to say, so we've got the qualitative meaning of experience. We've got Foucault, we've got this important understanding of meaning as something much richer than the way we normally try and map this out. And with Tamash, you brought out very much the social context of humans, which this project was started by someone called Professor Gavin Flood, who's very much interested in the way in which basic interactive relational structure of human thought, if you like, language and the rest of it, is in fact social, and that therefore the social also generates kinds of transcendence.
Can I ask you a question? Is there any culture that doesn't have a concept that corresponds to transcendence?
Great question.
In a way, that's good because it leads back to my question back to you, which is that thing of what we would want to do if we want to replace the old idea of transcendence. And in this context, I think Nietzsche, especially, if he's the beginning of part of this, is coming from a place where he sees transcendence as anything that is rejecting your basic material reality, i.e., God, or the supernatural. Or something, or mind as separate, indeed, from body, right? Anything that, and he's coming from Feuerbach, who's the man who said, you are what you eat the first time, i.e., let's be material, let's be part of nature, and not expect that some separate transcendent sphere is where we really are located and can be saved. And this is and the reason we're going into this, partly because modern religion, that's true for a lot of people, we're not waiting for transcendence, it's what's here. So it's kind of an immanent transcendence that we're looking for. But then, in a way, that's where we're at the point in history where we need people to redefine what that means. Mm. Because as you said, in a way, all of you, reductionism tends to say there just isn't any transcendence. Mm. And bad evolutionary anthropology says it's just about you know, surviving long enough to make babies, but we don't want to talk about these higher functions.
That's why it's so exciting, the moment that we're living now, because I really think we are redefining transcendence. We're bringing transcendence to the bones in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. I think exactly. And people want it because people's feelings about philosophy and religion have often changed. So if you were going to point to forms of transcendence, what you would call transcendence, are there things that you would kind of pull out as important?
Yeah.
Tamás, was that a question to you? Or?
Oh, right, I see.
Don't worry, we can say
that. So the direction I don't have an answer. The direction I'm thinking is more the what kind of function this concept of transcendence would play in narratives, in group narratives that have groups bond, whether we could predict the kind of transcendence, and I don't know the answer to this, whether we could predict the kind of transcendence concepts societies, cultures would come up by the techno-ecological environment they live in. So that they would not only be a consequence of a cumulative cultural drift, but somehow would be predictable to some extent by their ecology and the way they interact with their ecology. And I don't know the answer.
There is a fantastic, that's a point of genius, because there is a fantastic, it's been done, but I know you didn't know about it, so the idea stands. Often you get convergence, but if you want to read on somebody who's actually explored that idea, there's a wonderful essay by a guy called Robert Sapolsky, mapping different ecologies and seeing what kind of transcendence emerges. So, for example, are you more likely to have an idea of transcendence that is embodied, that is distributed in several smaller gods that lives in the river and in the mountains, or are you more likely to have an idea of transcendence that is actually out there? Are you more likely to have an idea of transcendence that you will only get to enjoy afterlife, or an idea of transcendence that is in the here and now? So what is beautiful about this idea is that, of course, it brings back to the most basic notion that even in our dizzyingly diverse notions of transcendence, we're also an animal that is embedded in our ecology. Because even our transcendence is depending on our ecology.
Hugely, even in the individual. Yeah. So if you have a transcendent experience, and you have that transcendent experience via mushrooms, you will apply a certain meaning that has a very spiritual meaning. You won't attribute it to God or anything like that, but you'll have a sense of transcendence of connectivity. Suddenly you have a disillusionment of the ego, and you feel fully connected to people, and not just people, but social can be social with animals or trees, or it's ecology, you and your interaction with the environment. If you have that exact same experience perceptually, not through mushrooms, but it just happens to you, because sometimes that happens, you're more likely to attribute it to God, right? But the description of the experience is more or less the same, right? But in one case, you assume it's a deity, and the other, you have something to do with nature and spirituality, nature, right? Perceptually, it's the same experience. What happens inside your brain is effectively the same. It also happens with long-term meditation. You increase the activation of your default network, i.e. the connectivity within your system doesn't increase just randomly, but increases selectively, right? And in some sense, this is both literal and metaphorical with, say, a connection with society. So you can imagine if societies are become more fully connected, not just uniformly, because that's not a structure in that, but I would imagine, I'm just thinking about what you're saying, if there's the basis for this connectivity, you will attribute to one thing, like a divinity, cultural divinity, because let's pretend that's like a brain, or you'll attribute it to something else, like a spiritual San Francisco type, Burning Man connectivity type, right? Because those are the mushroom based, and the other are sort of, so anyway, but it seems to apply at multiple levels. What I find really fascinating is why we care. Why do we have to attribute any of this to something like transcendence? So that's what I find really interesting. It happens. To me, it's the most basic thing. Seeing white is transcending, because this thing isn't white. But why do I have to put a meaning onto it? Why do I have to call it anything?
So do you think it would be possible to train somebody to have transcendent thoughts? Yes. They actually give a signal, like and they say a yellow pill, and for a while you put a psychedelic drug in the pill. It's tasteless. And they take it, and they always have transcendent thoughts. And they just give yellow without.
They do. That was without. So they
have
the same
people
effect?
Would actually have.
Yes.
Actually, we don't have to bang the microphone. Oh. And we without.
I'm accentuating
I know, I was
your
yeah,
point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, well, you can.
Yeah, this
you
can
you get the same placebo effect if you're doing an experiment on mushrooms and you say, I'm giving you
a Pavlovian transcendence.
You get and what's more, the stronger the sense of transcendence, the longer is. So what happens is you become very positive. You have all these wonderful benefits for up to 14 months, right? And the duration is directly related to how spiritual was the initial feeling.
Intensity of experience matters.
Which is not necessarily dose dependent. Yeah. There is a dose dependence, but the intensity of the initial experience and whether you associate it with a transcendence is more likely. Now, of course, what we don't know is whether that's causal or as a consequence. Now your eye movements change. You start looking for things that are more positive, and so you actually, it's a self-feedback, positive feedback mechanism, which I think is what happens.
Just very quickly, but what is you're automatically, almost implicitly moving towards the idea that transcendence here consists of a special kind of experience.
I don't think it is a special.
Or that's the kind that you're talking about, in a sense. That the kind of experience that people go, wow, that was amazing, I need to attribute that to something. Or whatever it is. Are there particular kinds of experience, and I'd like to hear Maz's view on this as well, if she has one. What kinds of experience that we particularly naturally, whether we're religious or not, whatever our framework, tend to go, oh, that was the special transcendence experience that I now need to give some extra kind of place to, as it were.
Well, we know a few that are cross-cultural that tend to happen around coordinated, synchronized social activity. And we know we're starting to understand why. So of course, dancing in synchrony, and or singing, and that always often happen after communal feasting. So in that sense, to study the context where festivals happen, you have a lot of kind of rhythmic drumming, and that of course has been today co-opted by kind of the modern techno movements, and you see the same kind of things happening. It also happens in relation to activity in nature, but what's happening is actually not very different. You see the dissolution of the boundaries of the ego go down. So I think if there's one common element experiential, is that the boundaries of the ego are going down, and that happens whether it's individual meditation or in communal kind of trance dancing.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And what's correlated with that is this broadening of the connectivity within the network that's creating it.
Yeah. But what's very interesting here, and in relation to your earlier point and to your question of what can we, you know, what kind of activities could we predict, where does it look like, and what are the cultural references, is like if we go back to the early Greeks, of course, they were polytheistic. They had a plethora of gods that are doing all sorts of different things. Usually, you had to, and you did, pay homage to these gods in different ways. You know, you buy a goat for one god, and then you sacrifice a lamb for another. But if you think about that act, they're all disembodied. You can still send somebody to, you know, skin the goat. With one exception, there was one god that you could not get away from the homage. And of course, that god is Dionysius. Dionysius, you could not pay or buy something to render homage. The homage to Dionysius was in the activity itself. In other words, Dionysius was a god that asked from you that you did the dancing, because it was only in the activity itself with others that was, it was not a thing to pay homage to him, it was the doing. And I think there's something very interesting there, because basically you couldn't get away from it. There's an ultimate grounding of it, no?
It's extraordinary. And that's very much transcendence that has to be experiential change.
Yeah.
There's still the question, though, which is, if you activate the default network in this way, or if you have this rhythmic dancing, why is that necessarily positive? There's no law of physics that tells you the emotional state has to be a positive one.
No.
It could,
you're right.
It could just as easily be negative. Why is that positive?
It generates endorphins.
But that doesn't, but that's, okay, but
yeah.
But why? Because, of course, emotions are basically, all they're telling you is, this is, effectively, this is matching my expectations or it's not matching my expectations. It's, you know, I should go this way or that way. That's, and then, of course, the nuances of emotions are telling you something more specific about the experience, whether, why it's, I should go this way or that way.
Mm-hmm.
But why, if you get seasick, what your brain's telling you is, bad situation, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You could, in theory, say, fully connected, shit. Get out of here.
Mm.
But we don't. We actually want to move forward to that.
Mm.
So why is that necessarily a good thing? Now, of course, you'll have an answer in terms of social, right? That
we'll have an answer to why.
That, why that would be a positive. Why your brain would say, this is a good place to go, because, of course, to be alone was to die, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to be collective was to survive.
I
so
don't
that's your
understand
brain sort of
whether you're asking the question at a functional level or
proximal level.
The why exists on many levels. Why is it positive? Positive, you could be asking, why is it physiologically positive? Then we have an explanation for that. We understand the physiology of why things feel good. Then there's another level of why, which is the why does something evolve or happen to be felt in that way? What was the reason for that?
Yeah.
So
and that's the social answer.
One level is a social answer. I think it transcends social, but I think social is one manifestation.
And
it,
but
of
it's
an
further
answer.
Than social.
Yeah,
it
sure.
has to do with the very basic problem that any organism has to solve, which is, do I go towards something, do I go away from something? To go towards something, you need motivation to do so. Many times you have to overcome pain. So what many of the stuff that you're generating in this activity are endogenous opioids. In other words, they're natural painkillers. So for instance, take dogs when they fight. Or any of you, if you've been in a fight. Yeah, you look like you've been in a fight. you will be, or in an accident, you'll be really surprised that you do not feel the pain. You will get hurt. And then as your body starts to go down, you go, fuck, you're really in pain. Why? Because you generated this stuff that is natural painkillers. So a lot, I'm not saying that's all, but if I think there is part of it, there's also, it just
I
feels
agree.
Good.
I think there's part. I think there's another part. Which has everything to do with existence.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, this is the most basic level, because I like to reduce it to the most simple, because if it's true there, it has to be all true. So your brain does nothing but relationships. It doesn't do anything in absolutes, which means everything exists necessarily in relationships, not just social, but if I stop your eyes from moving, the whole world disappears, because your brain needs change, right? If it doesn't have change, nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that sense, we only ever exist in relation to the world, right? Which means the only way you can exist is if the world changes as a consequence from you,
mm-hmm.
that you have an effect. I don't mean this in an egocentric way at all, but if you have no impact, if I don't push, a ghost, in a sense, doesn't, it can't affect anything, so they don't, that's why they're a ghost, they don't exist,
mm-hmm.
right? And so by physically impacting, by having a relationship, I affect as well, she affects me, I affect more. And now I have a sense of existence.
Mm.
I literally am now.
Mm.
Without that, I don't literally exist.
Mm.
And so I think that's what's happening. That's what we hear as transcendence, is a sense of existence.
Mm.
I now am here.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I matter or anything like that. Mattering then comes into this, right?
Mm.
But just the sheer sense of existence, because I think the brain needs, that's all that it can is do contrast. It can only do relationships.
And that actually nicely complements your very first point, which is that not only are these activities pleasurable, not only do they help to create a social space, which is needful for our survival, but also that they genuinely reinforce what it is for us to live.
Yes.
To live both existentially in terms of the quality
mm-hmm.
of experience, but also to live literally in the sense of reminding ourselves that we're cognitively active
yes.
and alive, basically.
Yeah.
Without which we couldn't. So the idea that
I don't know if we need cognitive there, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. But
mm-hmm.
there's something happening
mm-hmm.
in the mind, as
mm-hmm.
it were, which is useful, because I think again a lot of crude reductionisms treat human existence and human survival as a sort of steady state that is not in fact terribly interactive. If you
yes.
see what I mean.
This is very important, and that's basically the work that we do with Tamashii in social is at the core of this, because it's basically old reduction evolutionary theory saw organisms as passive recipients of life. Right? Today, what we work with is something called niche construction. So we understand that whether you're human or a bug, not only you have to adapt to your world, you change it in the process of just existing. Not only that, you change it. Because you change it, the environment feeds back to you. Mm-hmm. So the selection pressures upon you have been changed by you indirectly. And that in turn changes what you have to do in order to continue that endless cycle of living. Mm-hmm. But if you see what I mean, it's basically I'm grounding what you're saying. Yeah. It's the interactivity. It's crucial.
Ecological is by definition.
Exactly. Yeah, it's ecology is never fixed.
So
dynamic.
But it's the notion. I think then we can describe that literally. I mean, literally, for instance, a worm, how it changes its environment. But when we take it to kind of phenomenological level, I think this is what we feel, we need to feel that it matters. Mm-hmm. So for instance, when we look at communication, this is just grounding in technology, for instance. When we look at communicational technologies, mm-hmm. we find that it's like eerie, because you think we're looking at really big picture, abstract stuff here. It's okay, how can we apply this to a tech startup? And how do we communicate, you know, the nature of email versus Skype versus text messaging. And basically, boom, it's exactly as we would predict. In other words, tell me how interactive you are. Tell me how much feedback you're giving me in your technology, and I'll tell you how happy I am with it. Mm-hmm. I will respond. So we found in our lab that people respond, their level of self-satisfaction and happiness after a given interaction maps directly onto the speed and the interactivity of the feedback loop. So, for example, you have face-to-face here. Right? Of course, face-to-face is multi-channel. No, we're seeing each other. There's also smell, and I can really see if your face is changing. You're nodding, so okay, I know that I'm not talking to a wall, right? Then we have Skype. Skype obviously takes especially the smell, but we still. Then we have phone. Phone takes out the visual, but still you have the voice. Then we go into instant messaging. But of course, instant messaging evolved key features of this element. Not dot, dot, dot. I know you're there. You're writing back to me. Yeah. You know, the green light. All of these are, we should have predicted the evolution of the, like, evolution of emoticons, but that's a different thing. And then you have email. And that's why email is so horrid, because you are talking to a wall. Right, I don't know if you're there. It's different when I know you're responding quickly. At least there's an element. But anyway, that's just a little applied user case of just to draw an arc from these things that are actually quite big picture. But interactivity and niche construction are a fundamental aspect of understanding human nature, I think.
And that's a really helpful point in the sense that it reminds us that the ecology that we're talking about, that defines the human and its mechanisms for rising and creating new elements, is not just natural ecology as the way we think of it, it's also culture, it's also technology.
Again, the same thing. You know, because we're niche constructors, part of our niche is social, cultural. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Tamás was talking earlier about it, and it's a beautiful, subtle point. On you will learn from your peers the technologies on how to hunt, how to build tools. Mm-hmm. Those, where is social, where is cultural, where is natural? Mm-hmm. Part of our nature is to be tool makers. Mm-hmm. So
actually we need a new way of mapping those spheres that allows for the interactions between them, and then we start to get a better picture of meaning and transcendence.
That's the power of giving.
Yes. Let me
because giving is to affect. And to have an impact on the world, so therefore the brain perceives giving to have
exist.
A far, far, much more value in receiving.
Yeah.
I exist. So hence the power.
I give, therefore I exist.
Exactly.
Yes.
Let me just take a moment because we've. I know you guys have to be out the door by 1:45 because you have an appointment at 7.
1:45? No.
How
I think we can leave at 7.
5 to 7.
Okay, just a little bit. Okay, good. So I wanted to, if Maz had anything to say, and then I wanted to open it up. People have questions they want to ask.
Yeah, my point is really to summarize what everybody here said. Just in 2 years running Wisha as a business, which is really connecting wishes and givers to one another, so the givers to help the wishes make their wishes happen. For me, there's two things that links to transcendence and that I've seen through the behavior and the demographic of people, and that is time. So looking at young kids, what their wishes are, and looking how that evolves to, you know, people who are 70 and 80. So becoming from when they're young, they wish for things of really high value and it's very, very materialistic, technology, laptops, Nike Airs, blah, 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 to where you're 80 years old, you basically want nothing. There's this yeah, turning point where you turn into a giver. And then the other thing is the intensity of experience. I think, so also if you, there is this, once again, point, intersection point where as young teens and adults, the kind of stuff that they wish for is stuff like, I want to go in skydiving, I want to go. So it's really, really intense experiences. And I think that is the whole, where for me, you come closer to that point of transcendence. Actually, the closer you come to death, as I say, the closer you actually are at that point of transcendence. And you will come closer to transcendence the more intense experiences you've had in your life. And obviously, the older you are, you're not going to have a transcendent experience if you're 10. But actually, there comes that point. And actually, that's what's interesting, where the wishes turn into givers. And yes, and also, you can also at the moment through the data see that the older age people are people who give more and they've got way less on their wishes. So I think that is the interesting dynamic for me, that relationship.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. It's also, in some ways, what you're doing is a really interesting way to see at a snapshot in the contemporary world the different kinds of desires that people are having at different stages, the things that are valuable to them.
Exactly, and what value that they place on things. So, and this is something I do in my daily life. Every day I ask people, what's your wish? What do you wish for? And yeah, and the older people get is like, I just want more family time, time with my family and friends. And then the younger ones are, I want, they've got a long shopping list of
actual things that they
yeah want. And that is back to what we attach value to in today's modern world, and that's back to connectivity and human relationships, and that's where the world is moving to, and that is transcendence. And I think once you realize that, And also, like, I, like, my ultimate outtake of transcendence is that the moment you are ready to die, you've transcended, and that can only come through really intense experiences, lots of it, and being at an older time, and then because then you absolutely detach value of material things.
So the goal is not to die going, oh my God, I never got that amazing car.
The moment you detach yourself from material things and wealth, that's transcendence. And going back to what he said with Wisha, it's about taking people from material to spiritual, because spiritual happens when you give and you gift, and we all about enforcing the power of giving.
So kind of a hierarchy of goods, actually, that people are moving up during.
And that is why it's so relevant to all today, because people on Wisha now and want things, want experiences. So we're actually moving our whole business to people coming together to gift experiences and more meaningful things to one another.
Yeah, trajectory that happens in a way that ends up defining of kinds of transcendence. Were you about to say?
Oh, this I would slightly say a little bit different, which is that I don't think it's going necessarily from material to non-material. It's, as you said earlier, it's going from receiving as opposed to wishing, receivers to givers, because the giving is having an impact and existing. And so I think and this is known for many religions, these four stages that people at the later stage tend to shift towards this other of the connections with family, etc., and having a need for existence in that way.
Well, that's interesting. Lots of different kind of criteria of what it is that people move towards as their transcendent levels and experiences that, that are coming out of that. I want to open it up. Are there anyone have any questions they want to ask?
I find this fascinating. One of the things I was thinking for you is about the sense of play and like contribution, giving, but oftentimes when people think of transcendence, it's like being a part of something so much bigger than themselves. And so whether it be like the play in a sports game that you're simply part of a team, to in war you're part of like a group or tribe that's like fighting, it's like you're part of something, you're contributing to something bigger, which then doesn't come into all of society, that like we're all doing degrees so that we contribute to the advancement of humanity. Is that, is the sense of play but contributing to something so much bigger, and where does that fall into this?
Oh, I think, thank you for mentioning it. I think that's an essential part of it. I really got to the conclusion that the card is so wrong, so fundamentally wrong at so many levels of I think therefore I exist. Watching animals play, I it really felt at some point it's like I belong, therefore I exist. And it's out of what you're saying. Because play is ephemeral, and that's an important part of transcendence too. It can only happen if we now all decide to start playing a match. As the moment that the conflict escalates or we drop out, there's nothing. It's gone. So we literally make it happen through our co-participation. So in that sense, the nature of co-creation, I think it's a tremendous, important drive. I belong, and therefore I make myself exist, and I make the thing in which I exist. So I make you exist, and so on.
I'd like to know whether a football player has higher transcendence than a tennis player.
Participatory.
Yeah, because they're part of a group, huh? A tennis player.
But can I ask, actually, leading on from that, maybe the question that I was going to ask is that, so Nietzsche and Sloterdijk actually take as their main examples of transcendence, which is interesting, it's a real shift, individual figures. And they're thinking partly in terms of these kind of mystics and monks and blah, blah, blah. And so Nietzsche has the image, and thus speaks Zarathustra, of a tightrope walker. And he walks, and everyone's amazed at him. And at some point, something happens that distracts him, and he falls. And as he falls and he's lying there dying, Zarathustra, the prophet, says, he says, "Did I waste my life?" And Zarathustra says, "No, look at the beautiful thing you did before you fell." And Sloterdijk's thing, his equivalent, is the idea of, he comes up with the most wacky examples, but he has someone who lost his hands for whatever reason. And rather than dealing with that by just saying, okay, I'm going to do what comes easiest to me now, he teaches himself to play the piano with his toes and becomes an extraordinary, excellent pianist with his toes. Now, the Sloterdijk's question is why this strange individual push towards something more. And he says, we can see it in the gymnast, in the yogi on the mountain. Why do you get people pushing towards these strange things that are much more than they could normally be, or would normally be? And it's just kind of bringing that to the table. Is there any thoughts about that kind of thing?
They might not be much more. They could actually be much more as a consequence of small steps that were individually. So if you take a duck, a female duck, and you ask her what's the most attractive male duck, she'll find the most natural plumage to be the most attractive. Okay. And if you can come up with a mathematically equivalent, she'll say, no, I like the natural plumage, the natural pattern, thank you very much. Now if you exaggerate a bit that natural pattern, she says, no, that's really good. Right? So she likes just a little bit more than average. Right? And that's the whole basis of fashion. Fashion is always just going a little bit, it's just moving, it's always moving. Not in any direction, it's just moving away from average. You can't have something way out here because they think, whoa, I can't see that. I have no idea what that means. And we actually have a study where we're actually measuring how far away from average does it have to be in order to shift. Right? Because it can't be way out here. And if it's right in the middle, nothing happens. It has to be something.
Depends on the phenomenon, actually. Some of them can push far enough.
Depends on the distribution. Anyway.
I'll give you an example in the natural world. So why, the question being, you know, why push more? And again, you know, Nietzsche was so good at, you know, you have to be on your own, the mountain with your eagle and your serpent. And we've just gone through the last 4 years of living with a mammal, which effectively has the same drive than a yogi. We didn't quite understand why.
What was the mammal?
Akila.
Beautiful. So dog. She's talking about an extraordinary dog, which is basically a wolf.
Yeah, so we have a wolf dog, and it's been kind of a communal effort. And when she was a puppy, she would, you know, start playing with things, and she would, like, the ball would suddenly go underneath a piece of furniture, and we go, "Oh, poor puppy, lose the ball," because then she was trying to get it, and of course you like try to get the ball to make things easier for the puppy. And then with time we discovered that the puppy was doing the equivalent of like, "Oh, you totally don't get it." She would push balls and things underneath pieces of furniture. In other words, she would create complexity and difficulty, and that was the whole point. It was only fun if she could just take it one notch. So of course, in trying to help her, she was like, "No, don't give me the food. I need to figure it out and steal it and like move my body underneath the thing, and then it's fun." And this was like, you know, we were hours watching this phenomena. But it led to many questions on exactly this point. I mean, why do not just yogis, but I think there's something on the nature of animals that need to adapt, that need to be exposed to worlds that when you have to change your strategy, how do you build internal, whether we call it cognitive resources, behavioral resources, internal resources, call it what you will. There is something that is a drive to create complexity that I think it can look like a bad idea, but it's not necessarily such a bad idea.
And it also,
or even to the sense that we actually see it as more beautiful.
Yeah,
absolutely. And that fits with your idea that we want things that challenge us, that are complex, that have this intensity of reminding us that we're alive, and that they are actually participatory, that we're engaged and interactive in them. So we don't want to just sit there and have the piano play at us. We want to learn to play the piano.
That's because the world changes. That's all that it's about. We evolve artificial life systems. If the world doesn't change, they have no sense of beauty. They have no sense of play. They don't care. Mm-hmm. And I mean that metaphorically. The ones that evolved in a world that's changing, they themselves become more complex, and they actually adapt their behaviors. So this would be a really bad idea if the world didn't change.
Right? You're just wasting your time.
I'm constantly exploring things. It's always the same thing. Who cares? But the second time when I went on the other side of the hill,
it's amazing.
Suddenly it was different. And most of the time you would have died. And
sorry, I was just going to say, and Tamash, in the context of sort of social interaction and bonding, is there anything about that would push us to do more, to exceed the merely necessary in some
sense? So the point of sort of I was trying to make is that the merely necessary is all of this. It seems to me that the transcendence concept that is flying around here is within the socially merely necessary. It is we need all of this, but there is something about the discussion and your examples, Paul. That they were wonderful examples, and I fully agree. The kind of stuff in which
you
need
to start that with a butt.
No, I swallowed the butt.
I know, but it was so loud.
Politically correct.
The kind of stuff in which participation enhances the experience. What we talked about was dancing and music making. Of course, these are very social behaviors, and I presume you would not. And of course, it makes a lot of sense that rather than watching a ballet, if you're dancing yourself, it's a deeper experience. If you rather than listening to somebody play a piano, playing yourself is a different, well, not in my case, but if you can. But if you take something very unpleasant, digging a hole in a desert, you'd rather watch than participate. Yeah. So unless you're, of course, an archaeologist, then there's a meaning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
there's
yes,
there. Yeah.
Yes.
So there you go.
So the point. I made the point. I wonder whether, just going by the typology of this transcendence that your group is playing here, is that I presume different group sizes will have very different kinds of transcendence concepts. Is there, is it supposedly, has it been done? What is the relationship between group size and transcendence concept? Can you predict that what a small group will have and what a large, what was the answer?
I think the answer, I don't know, it's hard to say. You'd have to find a place where you can discreetly map a particular idea, culturally and religiously and philosophically, onto a particular group. And usually when we look at these situations, you're talking about cultures that have spread. And so you're looking at a macro culture. And in that case, it no longer, it's very hard then to see how it was generated by any particular one group. So for instance, in Hinduism, what you're getting is this giant, giant, giant superculture, which is, but perhaps you could say it's different. You could look at which bits are picked up as relevant to particular groups.
But transcendence transcends social interaction. You get transcendent feelings. I know for you that's almost impossible to imagine. But transcendence is something that can happen completely on your own, in interaction with a forest,
but
in interaction with birds.
It
doesn't
just because
have
you do it alone, it doesn't mean it's not social.
It's social. My point is that social is not necessarily person to person. But
is that the way we understand social is not that social is when you are with other people. You are social whether you are on your own or not. You cannot get away from it.
Yeah.
You have the tribe.
You transparent, beautiful glass.
Exactly.
But in this sense, group size doesn't matter.
No, the point is that we're not making a distinction because the way we're built is that you carry your tribe in your head, and that's where we have all these tendencies also to ascribe meaning and interaction. It's like, in the film, was a silly film with Tom Hanks and the ball.
The balloon.
What's the name? Wilson, and then when Wilson starts to drift away, we all like want to cry with horror. And of course, we all understand it's a freaking ball, but we don't just mean we are with other people when we're social. You are on your own, and you're still a social being.
And in a way, you've already corrected or expanded this concept to be something that can work much more functionally across all these different things when we talk about not so much just the social but the ecological.
Yeah, yeah.
Where ecological is very much kind of Latour's actor network theory
that's
says
these
networks are much more something that are all our interactions.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The social is a model and also the natural and the aesthetic and so on. And,
absolutely.
And indeed, culture itself, these are agents as well.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. It transcends that. It becomes just an ecological model.
Yeah,
that means I can stop arguing with Tomasz and I can say, yes, you're right, the social does generate human.
You're right, you just have a deeper point.
Oh, suddenly our many year-long arguments has come to an end.
Oh, no, that would be a pity.
No, we can find a new one, surely.
No, so we can come up with new arguments. Does anyone have any urgent, pressing questions they want to ask? No,
well, even if they're
time.
Light and not pressing.
Yes.
That's also fine. Exactly.
Anyone have anything pointless?
Non-transcendent questions. I'm only taken.
We take any.
Yes.
Well, then, in order to make sure that you make your appointment, let me draw this session to a close. We hope to have speakers coming in again to speak about the modern novel and narratives of misery, hopelessness, and despair versus narratives of inspiration and joy and transcendence. But you guys have been amazing in helping us to, A, understand ways of thinking about transcendence in an immanentist world, B, thinking about ways to get rid of the reductionist divide that muddies so many people's thinking about materialism or spirit or culture versus nature, etc., and C, for just helping us understand what it is that constitutes the human. Thank you so much.
We would love to continue the conversation. If you guys have any feedback or questions, please get in touch. Even if to say you are wrong with big cups.
And this will go on the website for the project, and I might ask you each for just like a couple of sentences of any particular point that you particularly wanted to make as the end. It will be there for the world to see as your thoughts on transcendence.
Okay.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you much.
I hope
was that interesting?
Yeah, it was excellent. Thanks.
We're going for feedback here.
Hello, exactly.
Do we exist?